happy inauguration. This has turned into just one huge holiday, and I'm so glad about it. You obviously looked at the Washington Post today, filled with news about Obama, which is, of course, reasonable because he's going to be inaugurated to be president tomorrow. Have no problem with that. But okay. It's on every single page of the newspaper. You can't see this, but I'm now holding up the Washington Post health section, which I'm going to put in front of my face. And the health section, the whole front page of it, is consumed with three stories about Obama. One is concern that Obama is going to be getting a stressful job, and he might, like, age a lot if he's in office 4 or 8 years. Right. And so they've got a kind of a photo of computer realization of what he might look with a receding hairline and grayer hair. And then another guy suggesting that Obama should just chew a lot of nicotine gum to get off his smoking desires. I'm not going to call it a habit, but he occasionally does smoke.
Right.
Do you think, by the way, that he's going to, at the White House, he's going to be like this guy who goes out and stands in front of the door and smokes?
Wouldn't that be funny?
I mean, how else is the White House is a no smoking environment, right?
Look, if George Bush could survive 8 years of not taking a drink, I think Obama can handle it.
But on the other hand, he is the president of the United States. It is the White House. If he wants to smoke a cigarette at home, he could, couldn't he?
I mean, the Secret Service will tackle him and throw him to the ground like anybody else. If you break the rules, you break the rules.
But I'm just saying, you...
And no one is above the law. That's the lesson of this administration, this incoming administration. No one is above the law.
There you go.
If it's a non-smoking environment, it's a non-smoking environment. But he has apparently snuck cigarettes occasionally. I have to say, as a non-smoker... It's funny how much I don't mind that trait.
I don't either. I am a non-smoker as well, lifetime non-smoker. But, if somebody wants to smoke a cigarette, it just doesn't drive me nuts. And I'm going to go on record now that even though the White House is public housing and my tax dollars are helping to pay for it, if the president wants to smoke a cigarette anywhere he wants to in the White House, it's okay with me. And I would not favor prosecution, a special prosecutor or anything like that if he does it. So I just want to go on record with that.
Okay, good.
But anyway,
that might come up.
Even the health section of the Washington Post is absolutely consumed with Obama today.
Right.
So, what can I say? I'm all very excited. Did you watch any of the event at the Lincoln Memorial yesterday, the We Are One event?
I did. I listened to the beginning of it and the end of it on the car radio going to someplace and back. And then I watched the beginning of it last night, before going out. So I was somewhere, I've probably seen about two-thirds of it.
Well, what'd you think?
I liked it. I thought it was terrific.
Okay.
It's nice to see. You know what the best part of it?
What was that?
Probably your least favorite part. Did you saw Pete Seeger singing This Land Is Your Land?
I did.
With the radical verses?
Yes, he did. He sang,
and
he
on
sang
the other
the
side,
old, unsung Woody Guthrie verses.
The Woody Guthrie verses.
Private property.
Private property. And on the other side, it didn't say nothing. That's the side that's made for you and me.
Right.
That's great.
I just thought, the thing about Seeger is, I don't know. Did you read, Joe Klein of Time Magazine wrote a very, very fine biography of Woody Guthrie.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote it years and years ago. Seeger was just a Stalinist. I mean, I would be very interested to see what Klein or Ronald Radosh or anybody thought about his appearance there. I looked at it and thought, well, I don't know. You live long enough, and there he is being, celebrated by the president.
Well, he represents a long tradition, and it's kind of reconnecting a lot of the traditions of the American left and the center left and kind of mainstream them.
But he was a real commie. He was the kind of person that a lot of people on the left in the 1940s, 1950s, didn't want to be associated with because they wanted either a vital center or a respectable left.
That's right. That's right.
So,
and that's a long time ago.
Well, it is a long time ago, but he's still
there.
Part of Obama
is putting a lot of history aside, including the history of the last 8 years, and not refighting every old fight. And that includes old fights on the left as well as old left-right fights.
Well, it's interesting. I did a story. This is totally extraneous. I did a story on Greg Craig for the new issue of National Review, and it was about something completely different. But people who knew Craig for a long time said he was really good at bringing the sides together and reaching across the aisle. And so I said, well, you have like a good example of him reaching across the aisle. And they actually couldn't come up with one except within the Democratic fight or within the fights on the left. He was very, very good. You know, he had been a an Allard Lowenstein sort of disciple, and was, you know, he says he led anti-war demonstrations in his youth, but he was clearly in the anti-war establishment front. He, you know, didn't want to be in the SDS and all that. So, but he was actually very good at reaching across to people, but in these, you know, intra-left fights. Right. Anyway.
Which are big, so which is not, I mean, Lowenstein was the responsible, you know, rational, non-crazy left.
Well, yeah, and
that's a healthy, you know, only when you have that that kind of left can you then actually bring people together more broadly than that. I mean, you can't bring everybody together because everybody doesn't agree.
But that's what bothered me about Seeger, is that he was the Stalinist left, you know?
I mean, he was 50 years ago. He was gullible. He didn't do anything.
But I mean, you know, a lot of people have kind of the people who were real Stalinists, and I don't believe Seeger has really. What's the word to say?
He hasn't addressed it.
He hasn't addressed it
and renounced it in the way that others have.
Exactly. Others felt that Stalinism was so horrible that they felt the need to do that for whatever reason, and I do not know what it is. Seeger hasn't. So I have to say, it did bother me a little bit. But
what about the rest of it? What else?
Well, the rest
you?
Of it,
John
you
Bon
know,
Jovi?
The rest of it was just kind of, I thought it was kind of icky. I mean, I was untouched, you know, when Tom Hanks was reading. I thought some parts were absolutely hilarious. John Bon Jovi, did you see that part with him and the soul singer? What's her name? Betty LaVey, I believe.
Yeah, Betty LaVey.
And John Bon Jovi is looking into her eyes, and he's singing, "Change gonna come, oh yes it is." I'm sorry, I thought it was funny.
Okay, well, I guess that's
so. There are parts of it. You know,
I thought Jamie Foxx and Steve Carell were pretty funny.
Jamie Foxx was funny.
Steve was pretty good. Beautiful choir.
He did a pretty good Obama imitation, which I thought was funny.
Yeah.
Because you know, basically, you know. This is the day of extraneous blogging heads. Nobody does a really good Obama imitation.
No, it's impossible.
And Obama has a very distinctive speech pattern. It seems like the kind of thing that they could grab onto.
Well, it takes a while. I mean, I always thought it actually took a while for Will Ferrell to actually get Bush. I mean, it doesn't always happen. You have to sort of get so accustomed to somebody, and then something that's actually a little off can still be funny because it's just capturing the few words. Rare is the moment that somebody comes onto the public scene and their little tics are so obvious and Tina Fey can pick them up as with Sarah Palin.
We had one of
those. Very unusual that somebody gets a...
Now, I was a little dismayed that Tiger Woods was scheduled to be in this because I am a big golf fan. But Woods appeared, and although he did appear, he delivered a tribute to the military. You know, his father was career military.
Right.
And it could have been delivered word for word at a McCain inaugural event. So Tiger played it down the middle, which was good because, you know, he's...
Is that a golf metaphor? Because I'm not a golfer.
Well, you know, actually, it was kind of a political metaphor, but playing it... apparently Woods is friends with Michael Jordan, who doesn't do a lot of politics.
Right.
And Jordan reportedly told Woods one time, "Republicans buy sneakers too."
Right.
So I think Tiger realized that, and even though he was at the event, you know, the events after the election, he is the president, and Tiger played it straight down the middle.
Right.
But anyway,
Jordan didn't do anything for Obama, did he?
Huh?
Did Jordan do anything for Obama?
I don't think he did. No, I think he has stayed. You know, maybe if somebody ran on a pro-gambling platform.
Well, no, but it's a funny thing for me because when I worked for Bill Bradley in 2000, Jordan did cut an ad for him.
Oh, really?
But it was a terrible, terrible, terrible ad.
Oh, really?
It was everybody thought, oh, just the magic of Michael Jordan. Well, you actually have to have a good ad.
Well, now, was it...
People don't just see, oh, I will robotically go do what Michael Jordan tells them to do.
Did he do that just because of the basketball affinity? Was that...
I think, well, they knew each other, and of course, Phil Jackson... And Bradley were very good friends. That's probably the basis of the connection.
Yeah, that's fascinating. But I'm not aware of any political, overt political activity from Michael Jordan this time around.
Maybe he realized that it didn't work. So
yeah, right.
You can sell sneakers. You can't necessarily sell politics.
I'll do my Bill Bradley magic for you this time. okay, so now what kind of events and what's the feeling on the left about this? About this wonderful event.
Yeah, I mean, there's just an interesting level of enthusiasm as well as a lot of confusion. I mean, certainly and I haven't been out and around everywhere. I went to one party last night and went to an event this morning, which was kind of a fun sort of discussion performance about activism on the left activism under Obama. And there's a tremendous there's a level of engagement that this is a group that, when Clinton comes in or came in 1993 or whatever, is a little more wary and is very quick to sort of say, well, our job is to kind of pound from the left.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a very deep...
So what's the group you're talking about?
I went to an event that was sponsored by the Alliance for Justice, which is an organization they've done advocacy work.
Nan Aaron is still heading that?
Nan Aaron is the head of it.
Gotcha.
But it was a big crowd, and there were a lot of people from different, a lot of people from outside of D.C., at least judging from, the people lined up and asked questions, which turned into statements about, in classic left style about the obscure issue that had not been addressed heretofore, and it was outrageous that people weren't addressing their issue. There's a kind of identification with Obama as somebody who actually does have some roots in that movement, in that kind of activism, that kind of movement,
mm-hmm.
That excuses a lot of sins,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of interesting.
Well,
then I come home and I look at my email and I have a, the latest column from David Sirota. I don't know if David, who does view his job as pounding from the left about, the creeping czarism in America and how, executive power is taking over America. And it's just like, it could be word for word a column that was written about Bush 4 years ago.
Right.
It's just, it's outrageous that Obama is not, the Congress isn't providing oversight of Obama's use of the remaining the TARP money. And it's I mean, there's still a struggle between this instinct to just go in and hit as hard as you can, power is, your role in relation to power is just to pound them as hard as you can, and this sense of identification. Certainly for the next few days, the sense of identification is enormous and mostly prevails over everything.
Mm-hmm.
But I never know when the other instinct. I mean, which is not to say that. I mean, obviously there are situations where you're going to do lots of things, and the presidency could move in a number of different directions. But what your first instinct is, I always feel like that other one might just sort of pop up at any moment.
In your view, if his organizing past and his sort of the spirit of organizing forgives a number of sins, what in your view or their view are some of those sins?
Well, the sins might be, let's say, in the view of some of the people who asked questions today, not a not perfect view of what is a sound environmental policy, because
mm-hmm.
he's said nice things about clean coal and things like that, or an economic team that they view as too centrist.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not always and dangerous in that respect. And obviously. And a wariness about whether he'll move quickly enough about Guantanamo and the war.
You know, the Guantanamo thing was pretty fascinating. A lot of people were hoping for, maybe not expecting, but hoping for quick action. Then when Obama was last week, he met with the editorial board of the Washington Post, said he would consider it a failure if he hadn't shut down Guantanamo by the end of his first term. Which was giving himself a 4-year window on it.
He didn't say first year.
Think he said first term on that. We should check that. But I believe he was giving himself a lot of time. By the way, if he shuts it down, I hope he has some alternative that's better
They do have some. I mean, they do have some alternatives, and they wind up putting people on U.S. soil.
Well, I know, but I personally am glad that there is a Guantanamo and that the people who are there are there. And they're not in Kansas City. And they're certainly not going to all of our so-called friends who other countries who might take them but won't. And we don't want to give them to places that will torture them, and we don't want to give them to places that will set them free. So it's a very, very difficult question, and I personally think Guantanamo is a perfectly reasonable way to do this, but if they must put them in Kansas City, I suppose they
Talking about, like, putting them, you know, behind the fryer at a barbecue joint in Kansas City. You're talking about putting them
in some heavily, high security,
heavily guarded military brigs, right. Subject to, you know, military justice, but subject to the rule of law. I think for the United States to have a sort of secret zone that's ambiguously related to U.S. laws is outrageous. If we have some reason to believe these are, these are presumably what remains in Guantanamo is people we have pretty strong reason to believe are bad guys,
right.
Not the kind of random guys picked up. In Afghanistan,
I think we've gotten rid of most of those.
Are probably out of there.
Yeah.
We have to be able to bring some evidence to bear. It's a lower standard of evidence. We have to be able to bring some.
But
evidence
you're to bear hearing it. And, you're hearing it in some of the news reports now that people around Obama are kind of spinning this idea. You know, there's some people that we know for a fact that they're really, really terrible. They should never go free. But, you know, maybe some of the information was gotten from them in ways that wouldn't stand up in court. I mean, they're realizing now that the U.S. is holding some people who are not good candidates for civilian trials and who certainly can never go free. And you've got a situation where probably need to have a military tribunal for them and then put them somewhere for the rest of their lives.
But this is not new information. I mean, there were people who were warning 3 and 4 years ago that when you torture people and when you engage in that kind of thing, you're going to create situations where you're not actually going to be able to execute justice in any way.
Well, but you can't. I mean, we probably should move on to something else. But I just don't think that you can have a civilian trial for these the kind of trial that you or I would have if we were accused of hit and run or something. I just don't think you can do that in these cases. So
I think the commitment to close Guantanamo is profound enough and deep. I mean, I think it will be the first. I think it will be among the first executive orders.
So anyway, the Alliance for Justice. Now, the one thing that Obama could do, I think, to make them really, really happy would be like to who knows when or if, but he'll probably get a Supreme Court opening to nominate somebody like Elena Kagan, who he's nominated to be Solicitor General, that would make the, you know, would make them very happy. I covered a lot of the Bush judicial wars, and Nan Aaron and the Alliance for Justice were playing major roles in all of those in opposing Bush's nominees.
Right.
So that would be one way to make the left of his party pretty darn happy, is to give them a Supreme Court nominee that they'd be very happy with, don't you think?
I think so. I mean, I think that I think there are a lot of issues that are important. I think there's I don't think there's a nominee that Obama would potentially appoint. I'm not sure that there's somebody that the left would be very upset about. You know, I mean, there are people that.
So I guess Ken Starr is off the table, right?
Right. I mean, Ken Starr is off the table. I mean, I'm always a big fan of the of sort of the Justice Brennan Hugo Black model. I mean, I like somebody who understands that there is an inherent an internal politics of the court, and being able to count votes matters, and play the role that, you know, in some ways now it's kind of down to Stevens playing with Kennedy, kind of the vote you have to count to be a little bit more of an organizer of finding that consensus is more important than finding the person whose individual viewpoints are in line with yours. I mean, I think the right is better off with. I mean, I'm not sure Clarence Thomas gives more to the right than one vote, and there are other people who actually can do more than deliver their vote on the court.
Well, anyway, now I guess we should talk about how conservatives are viewing all this.
I'd like to hear about that. You guys got the dinner.
That's right, as opposed to the coffee and donuts.
As opposed to the coffee and donuts.
Well, I wasn't at the dinner.
You weren't there, right? And I wasn't at the other one.
I was. Okay, so neither one of us were included in this. You know, this, as far as the dinner is concerned, first of all, the people who were there actually are staying fairly mum about the actual substance of it. They'll, you know, they give you the impressions of Obama and how, you know, sharp or engaged or whatever he seems. But they seem to be, you know, they really haven't talked much about what's going on, but the what went on. But it seems to me that this dinner was a very smart thing for Obama to do, and totally cheap and easy. I mean, you just, you know, you just arrange this thing, show up there, give them an hour and a half in your hour and a half of your time, and buy all sorts of, if not goodwill, you buy some pulled punches. Somebody wrote that you know, he's trying to buy pulled punches, and he may buy some.
Oh, absolutely.
And it is more difficult. I mean, you know, when you're writing stories, especially if you're writing stories in kind of a pursuit mode, if the person that you're pursuing talks to you, that in a genuine way, that often makes things a lot better.
Absolutely.
So it just struck me as very smart and very easy to do. And and it's the kind of thing that the people that you're doing it with realize what you're doing it, but they still appreciate it. So it struck me as a win-win.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I sort of analogized it. My immediate analogy was to how, you know, if you're blogging and you have comments, you know, if you actually respond, if you come into the thread and respond to comments, if they call you, you know, crazy or deranged or whatever, and you sort of back up your point, or you just respond, just acknowledge it at all, the whole tone changes.
Yeah.
And you don't have, you know, otherwise people spiral into kind of insanity. But if they feel like they're actually engaging with somebody who's engaged back in any way, it's all different. Plus, I've always felt, I mean, to me, one of the most interesting things about Obama's form of bipartisanship and the way he thinks about bipartisanship is that I really always have felt, and maybe it's because I feel like I have a similar view of this myself, it's not just sort of like, who are the three most liberal Republicans that I can deal with?
Mm-hmm.
But an actual intellectual engagement with conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just liberal Republicans, but the actual nature of conservatism, which clearly goes back to, you know, his good dealings with the conservatives at Harvard Law School and Harvard Law Review, and so forth. Then this sort of extends it. I mean, it's really taking that philosophy seriously rather than just treating it as, you know, the opium of the ruling class.
Right, and he realizes that in addition to buying any punches or pulled punches, that he is buying people. He is talking to people who are quite influential on the right, who could change votes in Congress.
Well, and who he wants to understand where they're actually coming. I mean, he's taking it on good faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's taking conservatism on good faith,
right,
and kind of listening, actually listening to it, and not agreeing with all of it, but listening to it. And I think that's a political tactic, but it's also a fundamental part of his character that has shaped the way he's that shaped his campaign and shaped the way he's going. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people see it only as a tactic. So they say, well, if you don't need to, why do that if you don't need to do that for tactical reasons? Mm-hmm.
Now, wait a minute. Now, there did seem to be some sort of inequality between having this kind of elegant dinner at the very nice Chevy Chase home of George Will and having some liberals over to meet in the conference room with coffee. And so, is there some difference? Is he courting one group arduously than another?
I don't think any of us have the homes to invite him to.
There you go. Just go to Cleveland Park.
We don't have the level of security, and we don't have the household staff.
That's right.
That's all it is.
That's right. Didn't
no limousines for these liberals.
All right. So
no, I mean yes. I mean, it was interesting that they did it that way, but partly that was because, I mean, it's a nice gesture to do it on George Will's territory and on George Will's turf.
Right.
You know, to go to his house is a nice thing. You don't have, it's fine to, you know, presumably there will be many interactions with the various liberal, you know, thinkers or whatever the hell we are. And it doesn't require the same level of, you know, big deal.
Now, this inauguration...
I didn't get invited, so I don't care whether it was coffee or dinner.
Now, this inauguration itself, I've been really struck, just in practical terms, I'm talking about the inauguration as an event attended by X number of people. By the way, the Washington Post and the authorities here spent a couple of weeks scaring people away from this thing.
Right.
You know, basically,
and I think it's effective.
Saying, you know, you come, you'll die. You know, and
you'll get crushed,
and everything terrible things will happen. You know, and then the authorities close off the bridges between the District of Columbia and Virginia. I think there's been too much of this stuff. I think, you know, an inauguration is a stirring event. I mean, it's a really great event. And if you stand out there, I'm not talking the VIP seats. You just stand way out, and you're looking at the Capitol, and there's all the bunting and everything like that, and everyone's gathered there. I mean, it easily could be of a scene 100 years ago or 150 years ago.
Right.
And they're really striking things to go to. And there's nothing more that symbolizes a democracy, a working democracy like this, than an inauguration, this peaceful handover of power. And I found it amazing that the authorities and some of these media outlets would sort of scare people away. Now, it may be that huge numbers come, but I get the feeling that there are probably some that they have actually scared away. People who won't be here because they're still worried about, oh, the crowds would be terrible, or it's going to be too cold, or who knows what.
Right.
But I think everybody, take it from me, they should go and watch the inauguration.
And you're going to go down?
I don't know.
Well, don't you know? Put your money where your mouth is.
I have been to some in the past, and I think it's the kind of thing, like I saw a space shuttle launch one time, and it's just an incredible event. And I'd love to see it again, but having seen it once, I was pretty happy.
Right.
But I think people should come and look. If they're particularly thrilled by Obama, the historic nature of this, they should come. But even if it were just anybody else's inauguration, it's just such a big deal. And by the way, I don't know, have you been down there? I mean, there's no shortage of porta-potties.
Right, that is true.
You know, the Washington Post did an article about this, and I can tell you just from visual sighting that it's absolutely true. There are thousands.
There are a lot of porta potties.
And thousands. You know, if there is like a portable toilet quarterly, you know, trade magazine or something, this is going to be something written about and talked about it for years to come. It's
well, I'm sure there is.
Amazing.
Every industry has its great moments, but no, I think that's true. And I always thought, I thought from the beginning, the 4 million estimate that they were bouncing around was complete. I mean, there were only 3 million people donated any, you know, even bought a T-shirt.
Right. If every single person came.
You know, it's really, really hard to imagine where 4 million people come from. And then you start, you know, you wind that number down and you realize, well, you know, I mean, 1 million people do come in and out of D.C. It's not unmanageable for the city. And you know, we know that everybody who thought they were going to rent their house for $10,000 didn't do it at all. I mean, none of that seems to have happened at all. So it was pretty easy to see. And then you add the rest, and you add what the weather is going to be tomorrow, and it will be less. And you're basically, I mean, there is something about, and I think I like what you said about it being the sort of like similar to a 19th century event, because it's in a TV age of politics, it is one of the few completely personal, you know, real space events with the president of the United States that one will ever have, and now just thinking of it that way makes me want to go down. Although watching my brother-in-law and his family who are here trying to figure out their logistics of how they're going to get down there tomorrow makes me not want to go. I don't know. I agree. It's been overblown, but I mean nobody really knew, and so they were all kind of craziest case scenarios, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. Now, jumping around a little, what do you make? This Lincoln talk is just kind of driving me nuts. Of course, there's obviously the whole Lincoln Memorial thing last night and the dramatic lighting of the Lincoln statue and everything. I just find it odd that, you know, taking the train into Washington, I mean, just the bare facts, okay, they're from Illinois. But I mean, you had a president who takes power in the middle or at the beginning of a civil war. I mean, we're hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Americans are killed, and this horrendous events take place, in which he prosecutes the war with great energy, and then at the end he's assassinated. And I just think, why are they pushing this Lincoln thing so much? I'm serious.
Well, I was talking to some people last night who were saying, you know, it's time for the Lincoln takedown. You know, really not such a great president after all.
That's good. That's good.
I think it's a matter of what elements of American history you connect yourself to and reconnect yourself to. And I think Lincoln is in many ways sort of intellectually a symbol of the tradition of the Declaration, the tradition of civic republicanism, the tradition that sort of stands in contrast to the kind of classic liberalism that kind of conservatism takes out of American history. I don't think it's a I don't view it as, you know, I, Obama, am like Lincoln, other than, you know, tall, inexperienced, and from Illinois, and troubled times. But
not as troubled, by the way. Not as troubled.
Not nearly as troubled. No, not as troubled. Not nearly as troubled at all. Which is also the case with the with all the FDR analogies floating around. But really, just a matter of what traditions you reconnect to. And Lincoln is, you know, just in himself, everything about him is, you know, it's just the richest tradition. I'm not one of those people who buys every Lincoln book that comes out. There are plenty of people who do, and the reason for that is because it's just, you know, all of American history is encompassed in his language and his approach to problems. I mean, it's plenty of people feel they can sort of think about the whole American experience through the figure of Lincoln, and that's the tradition that Obama's reconnecting to, and I'm kind of fine with that.
Well, you know, if you are a Democrat and you want to connect to something, I mean, Republicans have,
Republicans being the party of Lincoln, but.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if you're running for president now, you basically try to connect yourself to Reagan. Or at least they did from, you know, 1988 through 2008.
No, I mean, I saw that RNC chair debate, and,
right.
You know, pretty much Reagan was all they had.
Right, you know, Grover Norquist, this is the one that he was the moderator, right?
Yeah, yeah,
and basically he asked him for the greatest president or the role model president or something. And, of course, it goes Reagan. And Grover says, good, glad everyone got that right.
Right, right, right.
So,
and then he says, how many guns do you have? And they were like, 12, 11, 90. You know, I use them every day.
That's right.
It was quite a scene.
That's right. I've got an AR-15.
Yeah.
So you connect with this president who is in living memory for many Americans.
Mm-hmm.
But with Democrats, it is a little more difficult because nobody's talking about this guy being the next Clinton or the next Carter or the next Johnson. And of course, Bush is trying to cast himself as Truman. So you really have to go back to FDR or, you know, I think the fact that Obama is black and Lincoln presided over the Civil War and freed the slaves is just irresistible for people. But if you're a Democrat, you do have to reach further back in history to get your president that you want to, you know, wants to be your role model.
Well, I mean, I guess so. I mean, but Lincoln exists on a whole other plane of existence. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to say, you know, there's a lot from the Johnson presidency that provides a role model. I mean, I'm actually a little critical of this approach, but the argument that says, you know, if you want to get anything big done in this country, you've got to move really fast and really aggressively and look at what a short period it was in which we achieved the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, Medicare, Medicaid, and so forth. There's obviously some rich lessons from the Johnson administration. There are tremendous lessons from parts of the Kennedy administration. There are things you want to be skeptical of. And there is, you know, FDR is a very powerful model as well. I'm happy to embrace the FDR model, and I think a lot of people are. a lot of people are as well. I mean, there are ways in which Lincoln kind of works better for what Obama's trying to do.
Yeah.
But I think we're going to see a ton of thinking. There's a lot of, there's equal number of new books about FDR, the first 100 days of the New Deal and so forth. Again, I sort of pop up occasionally reminding people I did this piece right after the election in The Prospect called The Audacity of Patience, reminding people, you know, that the things that actually lasted from the New Deal were not actually from the 100 mm-hmm. days. They were from the mm-hmm. they were from the second New Deal.
Right. Like Social Security.
And a little bit. Yeah.
Actually, the thing about the economic crisis and TARP and the stimulus, one good thing about this is that it has ignited a renewed debate about the New Deal, which actually is, I think, a good idea, which I'm not going to actually get into, but I think it is a good thing. It's like when you have an impeachment and you start fighting over constitutional first principles. Good things happen as a result of that.
Right. I mean, FDR and the New Deal is history that we still argue over, as Johnson is history we still argue over. And Lincoln, even though there's so much, there's endless amounts of, there's a lot to be mined from that period, and it does seem to generate about 150 books a year. We aren't really fighting over it in the same way.
No, we're not.
That we're fighting over those other experiences. And I think the fight, the argument over the New Deal, which begins with Amity Schlaese's book, the kind of in its current incarnation, really begins with her book, The Forgotten Man. I mean, I think it's a healthy debate to have.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of it's been. I mean, I know what side of it I'm on, but
it's been interesting
to revisit that.
I'm totally agreed with you on the healthiness of the debate. Now, I wanted to bring this up. I don't think this is one of your big topics, but it's a bee in my bonnet, which is this Timothy Geithner nomination. Okay. And while everyone else has been celebrating, I've been writing about Geithner, and the deal is, of course, that Geithner, when he was an official at the International Monetary Fund in 2001, 2002, and 2003 mostly, failed to pay his Social Security taxes, his Social Security and Medicare tax, the self-employment tax.
The self-employment tax.
What happened was last Tuesday, which was, I guess, the 13th, there was a meeting, hastily called meeting of the Senate Finance Committee. Chairman Baucus and Ranking Republican Grassley, who have known about this tax thing for a while, break the news to the other members who didn't know about it. And they say, well, this happened and this happened, and here's an information sheet, which, by the way, is on the Senate Finance Committee's website. You should really take a look at it, or anybody who's interested should take a look at it. And the senators are kind of surprised, and then they produce none other than Timothy Geithner himself to come in and answer some questions. The senators don't have a lot of detailed questions to ask because they just found out about it. But anyway, we find out later that when he was at the IMF, the IMF is not like most people's employers. It does not withhold taxes from your paycheck. You are expected to pay them yourself, but then they will reimburse you for at least part of them. And to get that, you're given all these booklets and papers that you have to sign, I believe, on a quarterly basis. You have to sign that you are indeed paying this tax, and thus you can be reimbursed by the IMF for this tax that you have paid, because you're expected to pay them out of your own paycheck. And then Geithner did that. And in 01, 02, and 03, he signed for it. He collected the IMF reimbursement, and he didn't pay the tax. That is the Social Security and Medicare tax, the self-employment tax. He actually paid his federal income taxes and his state of Maryland state income taxes. But this strikes me as something that would very nearly bring down any nominee in years past, and is not being taken all that seriously today. And I think the reasons why are kind of obvious, but I think it's odd that we seem to be changing our standards, at least in this one case, for how you get confirmed as a high level, top notch cabinet nominee.
I don't know whether I agree with you. I mean, I haven't ignored this issue. I followed it pretty closely. But I don't know what I actually I don't have a strong opinion about it. I mean, it is a kind of it is a funny tax situation. I mean, we're all used to if you have self-employment income, you're going to pay self-employment tax on that, and you do your Schedule C or whatever. I mean, that's commonplace. It's weird to have a W-2 that you don't that requires you to pay. It's an unusual tax situation. So I don't. Whether you should say, well, somebody ought to know this or not, it's a little weird. The fact that he got audited and paid the years on which he got audited and not the years that,
right.
You know, the statute of limitations had passed on is ethically dubious, but not necessarily legal.
Also, we should point out that he came to the IMF after having been a high-ranked official at the Treasury Department. Then he's a big deal at the IMF, and then he goes on to head the New York Federal Reserve. Right. So you would think he has a certain level of financial sophistication.
Well, that's not. I mean, nobody. I mean, I've worked on the Senate around the Senate Finance Committee. I have no greater ability to do my taxes than not. I mean, it's not that there's nothing. There's nothing special about. It's just like somebody can be a Justice Department official and doesn't know some routine aspect of criminal law. It's that alone doesn't make me think, oh, he ought to know this. It's a little weird. It's hard to know exactly how. I don't know how exactly I should take the act of non-payment. Whether it's something that was you really had to know what you were doing and just sort of bluff that you were going to get away with it, or it could be an honest mistake. I'm not sure. I know what to think of that. And likewise, I don't know. I mean, I looked at the list the other day of. A lot of people will say, well, it's a double standard because, look what happened to Zoe Baird and Now this. Well, Zoe Baird was 16 years ago, obviously a different administration. And it was a kind of panic reaction to this, oh, my gosh, this nanny tax thing that nobody had really heard about before. Right. Since then, we've had a lot of nominees confirmed despite having nanny tax issues, Justice Breyer, for example, being one mm-hmm. of them. So I don't – and you've had others where the tax issues one of the accounts listed, Bernie Carrick as somebody whose nomination failed because of tax issues. Well, tax issues were it's like John Dillinger and tax issues. I mean, tax issues were the tip of the iceberg with Carrick's problems. And
well,
you know,
as far as nanny, I mean, Geithner does have some small issue about
there's a small
taxes.
Long ago nanny.
And
tax.
I have not made that part right. of writing about right. it because I agree. I don't think that part of it is.
Well, it's just a question. So then it's a question of is his now corrected error more or less serious than nanny tax? And if nanny tax no longer sinks nominations, which I don't think it does, then, should it sink this one? And then there's the other dimension that
you're on a slippery slope. You're going to say no Social Security tax, and next day I won't pay his income tax.
Well, I mean, it's not slippery slope. It's a matter of how you're going to weigh all these different factors, including the factor that, in an economic in a financial crisis, there are not that many people who can serve as Treasury Secretary.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you this question then. Let's assume for the purposes of this that you are disturbed by this by Geithner's situation. Mm-hmm. And his failure to pay the taxes. Let's say you are disturbed by it. Do you buy this argument that the job is simply too important, the crisis is too big, the need is too great, as Charles Krauthammer said, for to be caught up in trivialities? What do you think of that argument?
Oh, I think it's a reasonable argument. I think that there are probably. Bob Kuttner, the founder of The Prospect, wrote this in one of the first pieces that talked about Geithner in the fall, and he's since been much more disturbed about both some of the things that Geithner has done in the course of the bailout and about the tax situation. But a line like the number of people who can do this can fit in a phone booth, and I think that's right. I mean, there aren't many people who understand the big economic policy questions, and I mean it's. You have to understand something about what these things were that they were packaging and selling on Wall Street.
Right.
I mean, there's a real mystery to that, and there are not, in fact, a lot of people who understand both aspects of that and are kind of public spirited. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that Larry Summers understands the walls. What those things are that were being bought and sold on
right.
Wall Street,
right.
For example, and I don't think they're so. It's a funny situation where I've never heard of Timothy Geithner before, 6 or 8 months ago. So, and I, I don't kind of venerate him as he's the only person who can be Treasury Secretary, but it is a very small number, I think, at this moment.
I think Kuttner did write in the last day or so that he was hearing that Geithner's chances were
he did he'd heard there was
not
some,
as good
some real grumblings and some chance of it. Of it being a big problem. I don't know.
I don't either. I mean, I don't know who he's talking to. I presume they're clued in Democrats.
I don't either.
We should say the hearing is on Wednesday. And it will be, I mean, obviously Obama would have liked to have him sworn in before that, but which is one of the reasons, one of the ways you found out something was kind of funky, because he is one of the ones that they would have liked to, Hillary Clinton, you know, ready to go on day one. And yet the paperwork didn't quite come through. They didn't schedule the hearing. So clearly, you know, in retrospect now we can see that something was going on. But anyway, the hearing is Wednesday. So
that's the Senate hearing?
Geithner's confirmation hearing before the Senate Finance Committee. Actually, the Democrats wanted to have it quicker. I mean, at this meeting I was talking about last Tuesday, this members-only meeting, basically they say, well, look, Geithner has a problem you didn't know about, but here it is. And by the way, can we have this hearing on Friday? And the rules in that committee, I think all the other ones, are that you have to give a seven-day notice for a hearing unless you have unanimous consent. I mean, you can hold a hearing tomorrow if everybody agrees with it. So basically they say, here's Geithner's problem, and oh, by the way, let's have a quick hearing. And it just didn't work out. A couple of Republicans did object, maybe not.
But they said they objected for scheduling.
Well, they could have. Well, because you had, you know, you've got three Republicans on that committee, Hatch, Grassley, and Kyle, who are also on the Senate Judiciary Committee, which had Eric Holder hearings on Thursday and Friday. Mm-hmm. So there are perfectly good reasons not to have a Geithner hearing on Friday. So anyway, it got pushed to Wednesday, which is when we'll have it. So we'll see. I think it's going to be very interesting to see what Republicans do on this. Do they come out and pick someone of their members to really grill him on this and push him on this, or do they decide not to make too big a deal of it? And it could be for a variety of reasons. They could think that on the merits it's not that big a deal. They could decide that the crisis is just too big and they're going to let it go, or they could decide that bringing him down would be a bad idea because they're reasonably okay with Geithner, so maybe the next guy would be worse.
Right. I mean, I think they're reasonably okay with Geithner. I mean, he's a guy.
Yeah, they are.
Before this came out, he was as close as you could get to, you know, complete consensus. Yes, this is the right guy.
Exactly. So
in an amazing way for somebody who's not well known.
So I think this has troubled the senators who would normally find this to be, let's not say disqualifying, but a real obstacle. This has troubled them because of the times we're in, because of the importance of the Treasury Secretary job, and because for Republicans this was somebody that they could certainly do business with. So they are, I think, troubled now to be facing this set of facts, to have to be dealt with in some way. So Wednesday, at least, we'll get the public version of how they're going to deal with it.
Right. Well, I mean, my guess would be, my prediction would be that they, you know, huff and puff about it, and he apologizes profusely and, you know, says it was a great personal mistake, and, you know, he's confirmed 98-2.
Well,
with the two votes probably coming from the left.
Could be. Well, we'll see about that. I'll be interested to see if there's a full airing, I guess, of the actual circumstances and facts of this. And that'll only happen if some senators decide to question him closely. I just don't know if that's going to happen. We'll see. But anyway, does that cover
I think that covers everything we were going to talk
special
about.
Special inauguration.
From attacking Pete Seeger to attacking Tim Geithner.
You know, we did start out attacking. I attacked Pete Seeger. That's an American institution.
I don't think I probably didn't defend him as well as I actually mean to.
I probably didn't attack him as strongly as I meant to.
Members of my family could defend him better than I could, but you know, I love Pete Seeger.
All right, well, listen, have a great inauguration.
Okay, likewise.
And we'll do it again sometime, and we'll say goodbye for now.
Okay, bye bye.